Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is columnist, writer, Derek Bang. And we're talking about his massive history and discography, crime and spy jazz on screen. We're only going to be talking about this time around, the first book from 1950 to 1970. Derek, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about these books.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I didn't know what I was expecting. Okay. I'll be honest with you. And then I get these books, and they were amazing. This is a massive, detailed, highly enjoyable history. How long did it take you to put this together? There's so much information in here, it's frightening.
I love the juxtaposition of those two words, Mark, amazing and frightening.
I mean, come on, this has got everything in it.
Well, that was the goal. You know, it's funny, let me back up a little bit. I got into this initially with the thought of doing an episode-by-episode guide of Peter Gunn.
Okay.
Discussing the music in great depth. But I turned around and discovered that there was a terrific two-part lengthy article in Film Score Monthly several years ago, and also an excellent website that covers pretty much the territory. I thought, well, okay, I could bring a little more to the table, but certainly not enough to justify stepping on ground that had already been pretty well trod. So then I thought, well, okay, how about the classic jazz scores that were attached to films and TV shows in the 1950s and, say, to the mid-60s? And then I thought, well, that's kind of confining, and why stop in the mid-1960s? So then I thought, well, okay, let's do what hasn't been done before and really jump into it.
Wow.
From the beginning of when jazz started being used in soundtracks, which I figured would probably be the early 50s, which turned out to be accurate, up to the present day. And I naively thought when I pitched this to my publisher and McFarlane that, okay, you know, we can probably cover this in 125,000 words. And that's what the contract was for.
Wow.
So then 6 months in, I suddenly realized the hole into which I had fallen and was still falling. I can throw numbers at you, and it was just staggering. I wound up considering 486 films from 1950 to the present, and I ultimately watched 350. And each of them earned anywhere from a few paragraphs to several pages of discussion. And television was much worse.
Oh, yeah.
I initially considered 750 TV shows because they all had to fall into a certain category, you know, cop show, detective show, crime show, something to that effect, with a jazz score. And ultimately, 206 of those made the cut.
And I want to mention, we're only talking about volume one today.
Right-ho. And actually, we haven't gotten to the punchline yet. I wound up with 600,000 words on a 125,000-word contract.
Your publisher must have really had a discussion with you.
Well, my publisher never saw that cut. I was able to, first drafts are always overwritten. So I sat down, and I was able to bring it down to a little bit less than 300,000. But then I gave up. And I got back to my editor and said, look, I can't trim it anymore. I'd kill it. Can we turn it into two books?
Oh, I am so glad you did.
And they said yes. And so, yes, nice. We're talking about volume one today, which is 1950 to 1970.
What I want to encourage the audience is, you have information, yes, about the music and the composers and the show, but there's just so much other sort of background details that are in there. How easy was it to sort of research the TV shows? Because some of them I'd never even heard of before. And I want to mention, not only do you have the big and small screens, but you also have Britain and Europe, too. So it's not just the United States. You've got this is more of a global treatment of the subject.
In fairness, I would say that the coverage of the United Kingdom is also very strong. And to a slightly lesser degree, Western Europe, particularly Italy and a bit of France. But I couldn't begin to cover the international scope with the same detail because I simply didn't have the resources, quite frankly. And also, I would have gone mad.
Or that could be another book. You know, that could...
I was already on the verge, at the edge of the cliff of insanity. Anyway.
Well, and the other thing is, if you're a person of a certain age like myself, this book just brought back so much stuff that I had watched as a kid, and now I'm enjoying as an adult. I want to mention MeTV. They rerun a lot of these shows. Like this morning, I was watching a great episode of Peter Gunn. That featured Diane Carroll doing two jazz numbers herself, songs. And it really brought home a lot of the book. And just a warning, spoilers are inevitable in the book and maybe in this discussion. But let's get talking about some of this stuff because there's so much good stuff to talk about. What would you consider the first great TV detective theme?
Oh, absolutely, Peter Gunn.
Henry Mancini.
Yep. I mean, everything changed then. For one thing, up to that point, a good percentage of the shows were still operating with canned music, library music, and perhaps some of them had a cool main theme, but then the interior music of the show would invariably be library music. And, of course, in the very early days, some of the initial cop and detective shows that came out in the very early 1950s, you know, several years before Peter Gunn, they were still using music that had been typical of radio drama. And if you've ever listened to old radio drama, that type of music is generally what you hear these days in ice skating rinks. You know, it's this tinkly organ music, very chirpy, completely and contrary to the drama of whatever it is that you're watching. So Peter Gunn comes along, and Blake Edwards, who created the show and wrote and directed a number of the episodes, hired Henry Mancini to do what hadn't been done up to this point. Mancini wrote an original score for every single episode for 3 years. And we're talking about a TV season at that point in time that had upwards of 35, 36, 37 episodes per year. A phenomenal amount of music. And then Mancini turned around and got a contract from RCA to release a soundtrack album.
And that soundtrack album was in my house.
And RCA didn't think it was going to do much.
Oh, that's
so
amazing.
So they didn't, you know, the first pressing was not very generous. Mark, you know, it is amazing to consider this today. That album stayed on the best-selling charts for 2 years.
And, you know, that's the other interesting thing is that soundtrack albums were very commonly released in the 60s. There were soundtrack albums for a lot of shows. Or you could buy the single, for instance, the Avengers theme or something like that. And then these themes were also covered by other people, which were, you know, for their albums. And they would use the TV show as the promo gimmick for their album, you know, playing the soundtrack to Peter Gunn, blah, blah, blah.
Right. And of course, only the main theme. And then the other 11 tracks on the album would, in many cases, be completely forgettable.
Exactly. Exactly. But you'd be sucked in by the Peter Gunn logo or something like that.
So anyway, following Peter Gunn, it was like the dam burst.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, not only did detective shows and cop shows proliferate and breed, but every producer turned around and absolutely had to have a cool jazz title theme. So, you know, those of us who enjoyed that kind of music were in nirvana for about the next decade.
Let's talk about a couple of other shows. And there's a show that you bring back. We're going to talk about movies separately. We're talking about TV shows now. A show that most people probably have never heard of, M Squad. M Squad was a great show. And John Williams earned his first ever on-screen credit for M Squad.
Right. And back in those days, he was still known as Johnny Williams. and, you know, M Squad was notorious for his time because, like the Untouchables, it was, well, today it would probably be considered quaint, but then they were both considered to be outrageously violent.
Oh, yeah.
But in its first year, M Squad had a, you know, fairly pedestrian title theme, but then the Peter Gunn, even before Peter Gunn debuted, early examples of the show were making the rounds in Hollywood before they'd actually had a chance to air. And so who was brought in to redo the main theme for M Squad, but no less than Count Basie?
That was the first black orchestra to do a theme for television, wasn't it?
That's right. That's right. And that was the other fascinating part of the journey that became these two books, because just as I wrote a biography of Vince Guaraldi that came out in 2012, and as that book was being developed, it became obvious that there was a parallel story which traced the rise and fall of the San Francisco jazz scene. And so as I'm doing these two books, I discovered that I was tracing the rise and acceptance of jazz in general in Hollywood as a genre to be taken seriously, the rise of African Americans being able to work in Hollywood. A lot of them got started on television shows and in movies. And then, of course, ultimately, later when we talk about Volume 2, the slow slide into obscurity that jazz faced as electronics came in and rock and roll.
Yeah, today it's very, very tough to find a jazz score.
They're out there, but they are very rare.
Yeah.
There was a cable show that was on, I think it was Netflix a year ago, The Good Cop.
Yep.
Has a nice, cool, little soft jazz score.
Now, movies at the time, now we're talking in the 50s, you have some really interesting films talked about in the book. And I want to talk about one I haven't seen, The Strip, 1951. You describe it as a very ambitious jazz score, practically a noir jazz musical.
Yeah, that's the Mickey Rooney.
Yeah, and Sally Forrest.
Playing a drummer in a jazz band, and it's basically a threadbare murder mystery that is used as an excuse for all manner of live, full-length jazz combo and vocal performances with an amazing cast of musicians.
Louis Armstrong, Jack Teagarden, it goes on.
And nobody remembers it. It came out, at the same time as these full-color, glossy Hollywood musicals, Singing in the Rain and all that manner of stuff. But it was a black-and-white film. The Studio B unit, people rarely paid attention to those pictures, and it is today all but forgotten. And it's not a bad little film.
Pete Kelly's Blues, 1955.
Jack Webb.
Interesting music score there, because it's sort of like old-time jazz.
What my father would have called moldy fig jazz.
What did you think of the film?
Again, it's incredibly corny.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything we look at from the vantage point today that Jack Webb did was incredibly corny. Of course, he was best known for Dragnet. And, he came up with Pete Kelly's Blues as a radio show at the same time that Dragnet was popular both as a radio show and a TV series. Obviously, the man never slept. But everything he did with that same exaggerated, stoic delivery. And
when he moves quickly, his arms don't move.
I know. He looks like an automaton. It is hilarious. the expression on his face absolutely never changes. So, Pete Kelly's Blues, which it's kind of that same Peter Gunn formula. He heads a combo at a speakeasy, I guess we'd say these days, and dabbles in outside examples of crime. The initial movie, the basic story has that his club is in danger of being taken over by a rival gang that wants to muscle in on the action. And Pete Kelly and his players are sort of sideways instrumental in, saving the day, the end of the story. And then after the movie, several years later, it was developed as a TV show where the limitations of those very restrictive storylines became even more noticeable.
Oh, yeah. There's some great jazz artists that appeared in the film. Peggy Lee, was great in that, and Ella Fitzgerald.
Absolutely, and of course there were 3 different soundtrack albums from that film.
Yeah,
because there was the traditional, I guess you'd say, jazz orchestral soundtrack album, and then the Pete Kelly Players had their own soundtrack album, and then, yes, the two singers also brought out their own albums of the stuff that they had done. So I guess actually four albums all told. Record collectors and people who enjoyed the music in that film must have thought they were in heaven.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is columnist, writer Derek Bang. And we're talking about his massive history and discography, Crime and Spy Jazz on Screen. We're only talking about the first volume tonight. The first book is 1950 to 1970. I want to start moving it up. Some of my favorite jazz scores in films, Sweet Smell of Success, Leonard Bernstein. Now, he had also done previous to
that Elmer Bernstein.
Elmer Bernstein, excuse me. He had done The Man with the Golden Arm in 1955.
Right, which was also an important breakout in terms of jazz in film. That actually preceded Peter Gunn by a couple of years.
And by the time you get a Sweet Smell of Success, I can't imagine it without that score. It's and not only that, it's got Chico Hamilton Quintet in the movie.
Right, and again, that was a film that produced two soundtrack albums because there was Elmer Bernstein's orchestral jazz album, and yes, his undercurrent music for that film adds so much to the incredibly sordid, seamy, nasty story. It is one of the quintessential late 1950s noirs. And then, yes, Chico Hamilton brought out his own album of all of the combo music that was used in the movie, with Martin Milner being part of the band and being ghosted by another player. Of course, Marty Milner went on to much greater fame years later in Adam 12 and also Route 66.
Route 66, another great theme. I think that's a great theme music right there.
It is. And, you know, that was something I discovered that just killed me. Nelson Riddle, of course, did the title theme that we all remember so well. But again, like Mancini had done with Peter Gunn, Riddle also wrote original scores for most of the episodes during the many years that show was on the air. All that music is lost.
What?
Nobody saved it.
Is this common? Is this a common problem that nobody...
I don't know that I'd use the word common.
But it's happened other times.
It has happened other times, and while you can perhaps forgive a situation like that on a show that wasn't popular and, say, you know, only ran 1 year, perhaps not even, Route 66 was so popular, Nelson Riddle was so famous, that it beggars imagination to consider that people did not think it worth saving the scores from those shows.
Wow.
I mean, you know, Henry Mancini had made a fortune with his two albums apiece from both Peter Gunn and Mr. Lucky, and nobody ever put out a soundtrack album for Route 66.
That's amazing. I want to talk about a composer that through your book I have learned to love. Lalo Schifrin? Is it
Lalo Schifrin? Oh, my main man. Oh, my goodness.
I've actually gone out because of your book and bought several sort of compilations of Schifrin compositions.
And?
I love him. He was one of the great film composers.
Yeah, oh, well, he's still with us.
Yeah. But talk about some of the compositions that he did.
Well, of course, When you mention Lalo Schifrin to people who know him, immediately everybody thinks of Mission Impossible.
Yep.
And Schifrin was one of the smart ones. He got two albums of music out of Mission Impossible. And as much as I enjoy his music for that show, and by the way, that I love that title theme, and a lot of people don't realize that it's in 5/4 time. Huh. And that's one of the reasons it sounds so cool. It's got that odd syncopation. But right about the same time, I have to say, personally, I prefer the title theme that he wrote for Mannix.
Oh, yeah.
And again, it's an unexpected syncopation. It's a waltz. It's in 3/4 time. It is one of the few examples of a jazz waltz that I encountered that was attached to a detective TV series. And it is such a cool theme. And man, when you listen to his, you don't get this in the version that you here at the top of the TV show because it's short, but his fully fleshed version has a killer piano solo in the middle. I mean, there's footage of Schifrin in the early days when he was working as a pianist in Dizzy Gillespie's band, where you can't even see his fingers. He's playing so fast. He is just stunning. And he went on to do so many things.
Cincinnati Kid.
Yes. Oh, with that great Ray Charles title theme. Cool Hand Luke.
Right.
And then another great one, Bullet.
Yes.
Oh, the title theme. The title theme for Bullet is just amazing.
Now,
and it creeps up on you.
We're barely scratching the surface, people in the audience listening to us. We are barely scratching the surface. I want to talk about The Ipcress File, John Barry. 1965 film with Michael Caine. That music, I really have always, since the first time I saw the film, it was really an interesting theme music that has stuck with me. And reading your book, I realized it was written for the cimbaloni.
Cimbalone.
And it's sort of like in sort of an homage to the third man zither kind of music.
Yes, that's right. Very perceptive. That's extremely right. Although the cimbalom has a deeper, throatier twang.
Yeah.
And of course, Barry had already become quite famous by 1965 as the guy who was scoring the James Bond films. And the interesting story behind the development of the Ipcress File is that Bond co-producer Harry Saltzman decided that he wanted to start not exactly a rival series, but another secret agent spy series that was the complete antithesis of Bond, which by 1965 had already become somewhat flamboyant and frivolous. So Saltzman wanted to develop a series about a working class spy, and so he turned to Len Deighton's books, which feature a character who's never named throughout the series. He's just the protagonist. But, of course, movie heroes have to have names. So Michael Caine was dubbed Harry Palmer, and that's how we think of him to this day. And so Barry also went in a totally different direction to provide a thoughtful jazz theme for this working-class bloke who is battling inter-office memos and forms far more frequently than he's likely to be out on the street skirmishing with bad guys, although during the course of the film he gets set upon rather savagely. And Barry's theme for this film and the many different arrangements of that title theme throughout the story, I mean, the only word that comes to mind is sinister.
Yeah.
It adds such an undercurrent of malevolence and menace. And every time that music kicks in, you know, oh, my goodness, something bad's about to happen.
Now, the amazing thing is the breadth of your book, yes, it hits all the high points. Cincinnati Kid, Charade, Henry Mancini, Ipcress Files. You also hit some of the low points of his filmdom. I want to mention Satan in High Heels, 1962. I don't know where you dug that up. I read that, and I have to, like, watch that movie. I have to find that movie.
Did you watch it?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
It's actually not hard to find illegitimately.
Okay, all right, all right, all right, all right, okay.
It is, I mean, there were A movies, and there were B movies. I'd say this was about a J or a K.
Oh, my God. But the interesting thing about it is that the film's strongest asset, and this is in your own words, was the big band score.
Oh, it's an astonishing score.
What happened? How did it manage that?
Well, when you're working on a really cheap movie and you don't have much of a budget, a clever way to save money is to have a lot of montage scenes without dialogue, because looping is expensive. Okay? So there are numerous sequences in this film which go 3, 4, 5 minutes with no dialogue at all. So what are you going to do? You got to fill it with music. So that gave, and you're going to have to remind me, I am blanking right at the moment on the composer on that film.
I can't remember it myself, but
he was given this space.
And he just went to town?
Yes. And so you have these long jazz compositions, and I mean, they are terrific jazz compositions. It's a full-fledged big band jazz score. And so when you get the album, and this was an indication of how good the music was, because JK Movies almost never produce soundtrack albums, but this one did, and you realize as you listen to the tracks on the album, well, you know what? That's exactly the way I heard them in the film. They didn't have to go back and re-record at length. They were already recorded at length.
Wow. We are almost out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I hope we've whet people's appetites. But I want to mention there's some interesting things. And I remember this as a kid. There's a show called Danger Man, which had Patrick McGoohan in it. In
right.
Europe.
We knew it as Secret Agent.
Secret Agent Man. And they stuck Secret Agent Man, the song, on the soundtrack, I thought, here. But the music in the original Danger Man is really fascinating.
Yeah, that's Edwin Astley. And Danger Man actually existed in two formats. It started out, by the way, this is a British show, we should probably clarify.
Right.
It started out as a half-hour drama and ran one season of 39 episodes, I believe. And the music for the half-hour version is dramatic, but the title theme is kind of meh. And then after about a year and a half or so, once the Bond phenomenon had hit, Danger Man was brought back again with Patrick McGoohan as a one-hour show, which with much better developed stories. And this time, Edwin Astley's music is just terrific. And the title theme that he wrote for the new one-hour version, which is subtitled High Wire, has this great harpsichord line.
Yeah, yeah.
How often do you encounter jazz harpsichord?
We could be talking about this one volume for years. That's how good it is.
Well, thank you.
My guest tonight is columnist, writer Derek Bang. And we've been talking about his massive history and discography, and there's just so much more in it. Crime and Spy Jazz on Screen. And we're talking about tonight the first book. We're having him back to talk about the second book. We'll probably get just as far then. 1950 to 1970 tonight. We'll come back and we'll do the second book later. Derek, this has been a real pleasure. And this book literally changed my record collection. It's like I went out and I started buying all this Lalo Schifrin stuff. And then all sorts of other stuff, collections of spy and jazz music, just to listen to it based on your book. So thank you for that.
Well, I hope the expense was justified.
Oh, it was. It was fantastic. These books are just amazing. Derek, we'll talk again. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.